This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a child, Gabriel Calvacoresi spent a lot of time sitting on the floor daydreaming and observing the world. Gabby was born with a visual condition called nystagmus, in which the eyes are constantly in spasm. So while Gabby was slow to learn how to walk and balance, there was plenty of time for keen listening and deep thought, all of which became fodder for Gabby's poetry. Despite the nystagmus, Gabby was a voracious reader, turned to writing more seriously at the age of 13, after Gabby's mother committed suicide. The young writer's passion for poetry, in particular, grew to throughout her high school years and then into college. Gabby eventually went on to get an MFA from Columbia University. Gabby has since authored three well-received collections of poetry, which explore loss, sexuality, and the body, among other topics. Gabby is the senior poetry editor for the Los Angeles Review of Books and the Walker Percy Fellow in Poetry at UNC Chapel Hill. Gabriel Calvacoresi, welcome back to the State of Things.
It's so great to be here. Hi, Frank.
It is great to have you back. We just left so many unfinished topics the last time.
We had to keep talking.
So take us back to the beginning now, your childhood in Connecticut.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about this and talking about me both as having nystagmus and being a daydreamer and how much those two things had in common, although I don't think I realized that until later in my life. But I had this visual condition. I have this visual condition that I would imagine it's interesting. It's not a condition you hear about a lot, but I bet a lot of people listening have it. It can have varying effects on you. For me, it really affected my balance. It can make it hard to read. It can make it hard to do things like catch a ball. Depth perception can be an issue. And one of the reasons it can be difficult is that it often isn't treated. So there are people who live with it for a really long time and don't really know what's going on. That's something I hear a lot when I'm on the road now. People will come up to me and say, I have nystagmus. Or more interestingly, an unbelievable amount of the time, people will say to me, I think my husband has nystagmus. And then I'll get a letter later saying, my husband had nystagmus and we went to the different eye doctor and we got some help for it. And I mean, there are various things you can do. Because I wasn't a kid who was running around and doing all kinds of sports and stuff like that, I think I sort of I went inward. And so I was incredibly agile in my mind. I was always imagining myself as a deeply physically able person, having many, many adventures, sometimes in my small biological girl's body, often in much bigger bodies that felt more right to me at that moment. And
did this go along with a lot of reading as well?
I read very early on. I was very lucky that my grandparents were voracious readers. My father was a voracious reader. We had a great, very tiny library in our little village, but I got to spend a lot of time there. But I also grew up with my grandparents at the beginning of my life, and my grandfather was a lawyer, and a lot of the life of the law, I found out early on, was stories. And so I also spent a lot of time listening to him talk about cases. He used to do this thing. If my grandmother couldn't take care of me one day, he would bring me to court with him. And he would give me one of those, I can see it right now, one of those yellow law tablets, right? I imagine lawyers still use them. And he would say to me, I was tiny. The tablet was almost twice the size of me. And he would say to me as we were driving, I'm going to give you the tablet and I want you to sit and I want you to take notes on what you hear. I mean, I was tiny. I could barely write. And then when we have lunch, we're going to talk about it. And so then we would go to lunch and he would ask me what I had learned and what I'd heard. And I would tell him. And then we'd go back for the second half of the day. And then I'd tell him again. And what I realize is he was helping me learn to listen to people's stories. And one thing he would say, which I think about a lot in poetry, I think about a lot in just my life as a citizen, is the majority of people in this room are going to really think they're telling the truth. You know, they're really going to believe what they're saying. And some of it will be true and some of it won't. And that's something that that one has to think about.
Well, that's an interesting experience. If you think about someone who is inward, you're spending a lot of time in your own head, you're reading. If you only lived in that world, it could make it difficult for you to function in the outside world. But you're also having to deal with these other realities.
Right.
And in a courtroom especially, competing truths. Two human beings who clearly and honestly believe they're telling the truth with two stories that one of them can't be objectively true.
Right. Or neither of them can be entirely true.
There you go.
Right? So you have this sort of thing. And it was really, really interesting. And it was a great lesson to me. And I think it took me a long time to realize that was where a lot of my poetics came from. You know, these sort of persona poems and this idea of a kind of deep, deep listening, not necessarily looking for the place where you could catch someone out as having not told the truth or told the truth, but sort of those really intimate moments of overlap where you actually have to listen to, like, everyone talking all at once.
But it's a difficult place to stay. And professionally, you're asked to do that because if you're good at your craft, and by all accounts you are, if you're good at what you're doing, then you have to be uncomfortable or stay in that uncomfortable place where all of this potential is real and we're not going to make the choice, right, necessarily in this text. But I want to talk about this because at a certain point you started to get a holistic vision, you met a holistic vision therapist.
Abe Shapiro.
Well, tell us about that because that had an effect on you.
Yeah. You know, my stepmother and my father, somehow, I assume it's because my stepmother was working at a natural food co-op, so I would have been around 6 and a half, maybe 6 years old at the time. And somebody told them about this eye doctor who lived really like an hour and a half away, even further out in the country, who did holistic vision therapy. And said to them, you know, this person might be able to help with Gabby's nystagmus. I was having real balance issues and things like that. And I would go every single week to this gentleman and, you know, I'd get my normal eye tests and things like that. But it was also about every single week doing exercises to strengthen my eyes, to strengthen my eyes working together, to help my balance. I mean, there's still probably plenty of eye doctors who say there's nothing to vision therapy. Although in Europe, a lot of it's much more prevalent. I can say for myself that the kind of work I did there on my eyes, I mean, there was no reason to believe that I would be able to drive a car. There was no reason to believe that there were all, with sort of the way my body was and my eyes were, that I would be able to do any of that stuff. And so it was quite extraordinary. It was also extraordinary. I mean, I did that until I was 18 or 19 years old, and then I did it again in New York. But every single week to go and have the kind of practice of sort of concentrating and focusing, and this is something we've spoken about. Sometimes it was really physically uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It made my eyes really hurt. It gave me headaches. I would feel sort of nauseated. How to sort of be with that while, you know, understanding like, okay, this is going to get better. I have to be able to learn how to do these kinds of techniques.
Well, there you are in that liminal space again, that on the one hand, you are striving. You want to get better. Mm-hmm. You want it to go away. You don't want it to be this way anymore. I want to change. But it begins with accepting what it is.
Right. And also, and this is not something I learned until later in my life, but and maybe I didn't learn it until like just this moment when we were talking about it in terms of my eyes, that it wasn't until the point was never to get rid of my nystagmus. Like that wasn't going to happen. Likely some people's nystagmus goes away, but it was pretty clear that mine wasn't going away. Mm-hmm. The point was to learn to manage it and be with it and create strategies Right. For, and that, I think, has been something, you know, oh, he was a great eye doctor, but really, like, maybe he was my first sort of Zen teacher.
Yeah.
Because it, I learned as an itty-bitty creature a certain kind of non-attachment, even though I attached to all kinds of things. I mean,
sure.
I'm Velcro in many ways, but, like, but to that, I learned.
At the same time, those yeah. management techniques helped you do
yeah.
things that you wouldn't have been
oh.
able to do otherwise.
Oh, absolutely.
So it had a real palpable
oh.
material change.
Yeah. No, he was extraordinary, and I don't think... you know, I think I owe my life to Abe Shapiro, and I think I owe my life to the other vision therapists. And, you know, there are a lot of people around here who do that work. And, I was very, very lucky.
Tell us about your relationship with your mother. You talked about staying with your grandparents. Yeah. You talked about your stepmother. What about your mother?
I never lived with my mom. My mom, and in fact, my grandparents who I lived with were my father's parents, which is always worth saying because people always assumed that it was my mother's parents, which is interesting, but was another sort of level of difference. Like even in a small rural town where there were actually lots of kids who lived with their grandparents who I went to school with, when I would say I lived with my father's parents, for some reason that was very strange. And it created a whole other level of distance in an interesting way between me and my mother. You know, my mother was a remarkable, beautiful, very talented painter. But she was also a woman who was, she was very, very mentally ill. She had, we believe, borderline personality disorder, although I think diagnosis, you know, in the 80s and earlier was, it was, you know, everything evolves. So she was someone who I lived with her for about 6 months of my life and then was no longer able to live with her. It was sort of a threatening situation. And so I would see her throughout my life, but I didn't live with her. So she was both like someone who was a huge mystery to me, someone who I very much wanted to be near, but also someone I was pretty scared of, I think because I was not necessarily given a great relationship in terms of thinking about what mental illness was.
We will continue this conversation with Gabrielle Calvacoresi in a moment on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Gabrielle Calvacoresi, an award-winning poet and author of three poetry collections, including Rocket Fantastic, which came out this year. Gabby is also the Walker Percy Fellow in Poetry at UNC Chapel Hill. Talking before the break about your relationship with your mother, tell us more.
Yeah, and so, I mean, so it's interesting. I never lived with her. I loved her deeply and was also frightened. That is something, you know, as an older person, I feel a lot of guilt about. Not because there weren't things going on that were genuinely frightened, but, you know, I didn't really – my family was helpful to me in all kinds of ways, and I think sometimes tried to protect me. They tried to protect me in the ways that they thought was right, but one of those ways was we didn't really talk about mental illness in a way that, for instance, I realized, you know, I never sent my mom a card when she was in the hospital. I never went and visited her. Would that have made things better? I don't know what better is, but certainly it would have helped me understand earlier in my life that there were frightening things that might happen, but that she wasn't necessarily a frightening person, and that she was someone who was dealing with a really, really severe illness. And so my sort of balancing when I would get to see her and what would happen when I saw her and how I would process that, I think it's something I'll think about the rest of my life.
Well, you moved in with your dad and your stepmom when you were 7 years old, and you also went to a new school, a Catholic school.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about that
transition. I went to St. Thomas Catholic School, and I was not Catholic. I was raised Episcopalian, although I was a deeply, deeply, like, religious kid. My father and my stepmother were not. They had their own sort of spiritual life. But the Catholic school was the best school you could go to, and I loved being at a Catholic school. I remember that, you know, it meant a lot to me. And
what did you love about it?
Well, I have to say, as being a fairly religious little kid and having, you know, a real prayer practice and then moving into a house with my family who was not so religious, I was really, really interested in being around the nuns. Like, I was really like, and my parents had said to them, you know, she can't do confession because she, you know, we don't want her doing that. And I remember going to the nuns and saying, like, may I please do confession?
Oh, man.
Oh.
And then you would have to add disobedience to your parents as one extra sin because you had went to confession.
It just went round and round and round. I mean, it was really so, but I had a really I enjoyed my time. And I also you know, it was a different experience because I had grown up in a really rural community, and then my parents lived in Hartford, Connecticut. We lived in a little apartment on Hungerford Street, and so it was, the whole experience was so different. I'd gone from a rural public school to a Catholic school in a city. I was walking to daycare for the first time. I started to play the saxophone. I mean, things felt real different for me.
But let's talk about your perception of your own gender, because things changed for you from that public school in Connecticut where you were allowed to use the bathroom of your choice. Well, tell us more about
it. It's so interesting. When, you know, I grew up in this little rural school, and I think we have, maybe we don't, maybe it's just all these opinions or my own, but my sense is that we can often have an experience of thinking of rural people and rural places as really close-minded. I certainly grew up in a conservative area of Connecticut. But at least by the time I was seven, I identified it as a boy. I was allowed to go to the boys' bathroom. I was allowed to be in the boys' line. I wore boys' clothing. It wasn't until I got to Catholic school where I was told that if I wanted to go to school there, I could no longer be in the boys' bathroom. I could no longer wear boys' clothes. I had to wear skirts. I couldn't identify as a boy. The other thing I couldn't do was I had nystagmus, and I had a really hard time getting up and down stairs. And this was, like, buildings did not have elevators necessarily at that point. I was also told at the same time that I had to be able to get up and down the stairs by myself. And I think of those two things as really linked in some way. Ableism and this idea of I had to decide that if I was going to go to this school, which I knew my parents wanted me to go to, and I wanted to go to a good school, I had to just, like, take enormous parts of myself and put them somewhere else. So there were parts of the experience of Catholic school that were wonderful, the spiritual practice, playing the saxophone, which changed my life. But there were these other parts where all of a sudden I had to compartmentalize things like gender, my own abilities, and hiding what I could and couldn't do well, like walk. You know, I had to, that was hard.
You just said that you realized that there would be parts of yourself you would have to check and put away. Did you realize, I mean, was that conscious to you? You realized, oh, you really did say to yourself, I'm going to have to put this somewhere.
Well, I think I definitely knew in terms of things like balance and getting around that I had to figure it out, which was hard, and that I had to, I couldn't ask for help in that environment. So I had a lot of strategies for getting up and down those stairs and not falling, that where people couldn't see, like, how much I was pulling myself instead of walking. And so I had to a certain extent, veil my difficulty and act like I was okay when I wasn't, and act like I wasn't scared of, like, falling and things like that. And then in terms of, in terms of, like, my body, I think there was some way in which I understood that, like, all of these things that had just been part, we talked a little bit about lucid dreaming, like, part of my life that had just been part of my perception of myself had to become a daydream.
Was that the first time? There's an implicit criticism of you or of the way you felt about this, right? That no, you may not be who you think you are. Did you take it as criticism? What does it mean to you in terms of your identity and whether you think, oh my goodness, there's something wrong with me?
I don't know that I thought of it as something wrong with me, although I think I was a kid who thought there were a lot of things wrong with me. I mean, I was a kid who, you know, my mom was gone. I didn't live with my dad. Then all of a sudden I wasn't living with my grandparents anymore. So I think that it was sort of built into me a little bit, but I think that I didn't so much think of it as like there's something wrong with me in thinking I'm a boy as this is a secret you're really going to have to keep because other people think this is really wrong.
You, at the age of 13, you learned that your mother committed suicide. Mm-hmm. Take us back to that day.
You know, I was in school and I sort of learned about it before I learned about it. And I think a lot of people listening have had this experience on the day when they lost someone who really meant a tremendous amount to them. I was sitting in I guess we called it either like social studies or geography. I can't remember what it was called. But we were watching one of those movies, like Abe Lincoln reenactment. And I remember looking up at the clock and it was a little after 10 a.m. And I thought to myself, I wonder what it feels like to be dead. And I had never thought of anything like that in my life. And I was just like a young, and I remember thinking that it was very strange to think that. And then I sort of went back to my world of watching this film. And I got home that afternoon. And my father came home from work at some point. My stepmother came home from work at some point. And then they told me that my mother killed herself. I don't remember that moment. I think it's probably a kind of shock and sort of a trauma that I don't. But I do remember, I'll always remember this. They told me I was standing in the kitchen and I remember I walked into the bathroom and I turned on the hot water and I washed my hands until the hot water ran out. I just let the hot water run over my hands. And I think about that and I think like, and I think I was just, I realize now I was just so deeply in shock. Not because I was surprised necessarily. I mean, my mother had attempted many times, but it began this sort of period of just this enormous silence opening in my life that I didn't know what to do with because we didn't really talk about her suicide after that. And I think that I really began writing poems in that moment without knowing it, in that there was all of a sudden something so unspeakable, not necessarily in its horror. I mean, that maybe, but also just like, how do you even find language for this? Mm-hmm. I stood in that silence for a really, really long time.
You weren't able to attend the funeral either.
No, I went to school the next day. I mean, I often think that, you know, I'm a gay person, I'm a lesbian, and we talk a lot about the closet with gay people, but I think mental illness and I think suicide is another kind of closet that a lot of us who are survivors of suicide. Survivor is kind of a funny word, but I think many of us don't talk about it. And now it's why I talk about it a lot. And so I went to school the next day. I can't remember I don't think I was probably told to go to school. I think I just went to school, you know. I didn't know what else you would do. And then my mother's mother, who was not well mentally either, but she called me soon after that and she told me I had killed her daughter, which I also think that's sort of there's a lot that goes on that I think at one point in my life I thought was specific to me and I think actually is very common among people who have had someone who's taken their life. And so there was a decision made, which I understand that like it might not be particularly safe for me to be at that funeral. But it's also true that I didn't go to her grave then. I mean, I was 13. And I didn't go to her grave for the first time until I was probably 22 years old. I really kept it at bay for a long time.
But you say you started writing poetry out of that experience.
Yeah.
What was that poetry like?
Oh, it was, a lot of poems about... a lot of poems about my mother dying, a lot of poems about, but sort of the surface of it, if that were, a lot of poems about pain, a lot of poems about not being understood, about a kind of deep sadness. Also, in some ways, a lot of poems for the first time that were beginning to approach thinking about my own self as maybe having crushes on girls, maybe. I don't think those two are linked in terms of like, oh, well, her mother committed suicide and then she became a lesbian. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is I think that it opened up all kinds of ways of me thinking about things I didn't think I could talk about and that little notebook became a place that I thought I could do that. And so in some ways I was dealing with it. I was trying to find language for it. But I think that the notebook was the only place I let it out, you know.
You went to you applied and got accepted to Sarah Lawrence College,
mm-hmm.
And that was important for you to go
yeah.
there. Tell us about that.
You know, that was – I mean, I had gone to Choate for high school and where poetry was taken pretty seriously. And so I knew that I wanted to be a poet, like whatever that was. I wanted to write. And I was told that Sarah Lawrence had a really good creative writing program. And I don't even know that I really understood what that meant, but I knew that it meant like I could go and take classes to write poems. And I knew that I wanted to do that. And I got there and I was really lucky because the people who were teaching there at the time, Mark Doty, Marie Howe, Tom Lux, who I never studied with, but he was always sort of present. There were these remarkable poets, sort of really at the beginning of their sort of ascendancy into the world of American poetry. They were also people who were like teaching and were really good at teaching. I mean, I feel very lucky because I like to teach. I love it. I love my classes. And I think that's because I was taught by people who love to teach. But I was also watching people who were like going and giving readings and writing their books. And so Sarah Lawrence was this place where I really learned that you could be a poet in all kinds of different ways, and that teaching could be a huge part of that. That also sort of there were communities of poets who were teaching together, who were friends, who were really mattering to one another. It was also really at the height of the AIDS epidemic, although, I mean, certainly the AIDS epidemic goes on. But that was also very important. Mark Doty lost his partner while I was his, you know, during the time I was his student. Marie Howe had just was writing her remarkable book, What the Living Do, about the loss of her brother John. So I was also a young person who was coming into my identity as a gay person who was watching what was happening to an entire generation of writers and their families and their, you know, communities. So I was also watching poets take care of each other as well. And that taught me in a lot of ways how to be a citizen, I hope.
Citizen, a kind of community
yeah.
as well. Well, I'd like to, as part of this conversation, talk about the trajectory of your
yeah.
poetry and kind of what it means. Maybe what we can do is take you back to some of your earlier published
sure.
poetry anyway, and then you can reflect on that and we'll talk about how that has changed over time. I wonder if I can ask you to read Having Never Been to Gettysburg.
Sure.
This is from the last time I saw Amelia Earhart.
Having never been to Gettysburg. Sedge grass, little blue stem, bristle cone pine. Oh, if this were the worst of it. Not me, that insatiable lyric, darkening the doorway of small town beauty parlors. Brush grass, salt cedar, big top dahlia, greening above moldering bones, who know I've never told the truth, not once in my life. My name unknown to the field mouse, the skeletal cats scouring slaughterhouse floors. I was never sorry. I let the town drift from view, my mother still humming with current from the hospital's source. Larkspur, Prometheus, my unwavering hand.
Having never been to Gettysburg, from her volume, the last time I saw Amelia Earhart, I'm talking to Gabrielle Calvacoresi, who is a poet and a teacher at UNC Chapel Hill. When did you write that poem?
I wrote that poem. So the book came out in 2005, and that was one of the last poems I wrote for that book. I think I wrote that poem maybe in 2004. Mm. And I think of that as a really important poem in my life as a writer and as a person, because it's a poem where I really dealt with this idea of like not being the hero, you know? I mean, I think that was one of the things in a lot of my poems about my mother earlier in my life. They were all about me and how awful it was what had happened to me, and I was the center of the world, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with that in a poem, I think. But for me, that was a really good way for me to protect myself from what was actually really hard about that. And so there's something about that poem that is, I think, or at least strives for a kind of beauty but also recognizes that underneath any kind of beauty, or not even underneath, but like right alongside it, are like all the ways that that life is really complicated.
But that means that you've given some thought, obviously, to the voice.
Yeah.
Who is speaking? Who's narrating this poem, right? And you said earlier, you know, you sort of created a hero persona who is now going to tell this hero's tale about how you'd suffered all of these things.
Yeah.
And it probably was extremely expressive and meant a lot to a lot of people. What's the difference, and how do you get yourself to the place where you take those two or three steps back?
Well, you know, for me, one of the things, so that poem comes at the end of a book that is full of persona poems, right? And so poems written in the voices of other people. There's a long series of poems about a circus fire in Connecticut in the 40s. There's a long series of poems about people looking at Amelia Earhart as she's turning away. For myself, you know, I was sort of writing the same poem over and over before this book. Nothing wrong with that. I'm probably still writing the same poem over and over, but maybe I'm interested in doing it in different ways. But I was writing a lot about my mother, but I wasn't really writing anything different, and it wasn't surprising me. And so what I realized for myself was that I could use this technique of persona. I could think about other situations, other voices, other places where sort of my body of experience could sort of touch on someone else's body of experience, and we could find that overlap and talk through it, sort of like being in the courtroom again, like all these different voices. And that for myself, through doing that, I could get to a greater approximation of not just like what it was like for me that my mother killed herself, awful, difficult, but also maybe I could come to some kind of understanding of like what it might have been like for her, not necessarily even to like kill herself, but to be poor, to be mentally ill, to be living in in Vermont, when most of the mental hospitals had been sort of emptied out. Maybe that for me, that different way of writing and sort of moving away from a certain kind of centralized heroic eye could actually help me look at the situation in a way that would help me a little bit more.
Gabrielle Calvacoresi, professor of English in the English department at UNC Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Gabrielle Calvacoresi, a poet and essayist who most recently authored a collection, Rocket Fantastic, also teaches poetry at UNC Chapel Hill. You read a poem just before the break that you say you wrote in 2004. That is also the year that you say it was the year I didn't kill myself.
Yeah, that was a hard year. you know, I was at Stanford. I had a very, very prestigious fellowship that I was really lucky to have. The Stegner Fellowship. It gives you 2 years to write poems. And then I was asked to stay, and I was given a teaching fellowship to teach for 3 years. And I say that by way of just saying, like, things were awesome. Yeah. You know, I was living in California. But in some ways, like, I was doing so well in certain ways that, like, there was nothing left to do except like deal with the fact that my mother had killed herself, and I had had various difficult things, you know, go on when I was younger. And so I had a panic attack, which, I mean, tons of people, I'm sure, you know, there are probably a lot of people listening today who've had panic attacks. And it was terrifying to me. And it was terrifying to me because, you know, my whole life, my biggest fear had been I'm going to get sick like my mom, you know. And I think partially because I didn't really understand aspects of mental illness, but I was, you know, that was my rational fear that was also pretty rational. And so I had this panic attack, and no one could convince me that I hadn't just lost my mind. I mean, I really, really thought I had gone crazy. And I remember going to my general practitioner, and this was in Berkeley, and I remember her looking at me. I went in and I said to her, I have gone crazy. And my heart had really broken. I really didn't know what it was like to have your heart break. I thought I did until I had that moment of that panic attack and the way I felt after. And I really thought, oh God, like this is going to be my life now. And I said to the GP, I said, I have lost my mind. And I remember her looking at me and she said, this is Berkeley, California. She said, there are more postdocs here than you can imagine. You have had a panic attack.
Get in line, sister.
But it didn't mean anything to me. And I mean, I really, really went through a terrible, terrible period. And I went through a period where I was highly, highly functional. I was teaching better than I'd ever taught. Mm. And then I would drive home, get out of the car, go upstairs and like throw up. Because I lost 30 pounds. I was so anxious. I never thought my life was going to get better, ever. I mean, I really thought it was over for me. And, but I was really lucky, right? I was really lucky in ways my mom wasn't. I lived in Berkeley. I had access to very good mental health care. I also, at that point in my life, was fairly well off, you know, relatively speaking. Stanford paid me very well. I had come into a small inheritance. And so I was able to do things like, you know, go to yoga, get body work done, do the kinds of things that she never could have done. And still, it took me a very, very long time to come, I don't want to say out of it, because am I less anxious than I was then? I don't know. Yeah. But I began sitting. I did the mindfulness stress-based reduction through Jobin Kabat-Zinn. GP gave me the pamphlet for that, and I didn't do it for about 9 months. About 9 months, I did not meditate or learn to do any of that stuff. And then my psychiatrist and my therapist said, you should really try this. And so I was very lucky because I did that program. They have it at Duke. They have it at UNC. It's really amazing. But I also was, that program for me was led by a very serious Zen practitioner. And so I kept sitting after that. And so I think another thing that happened to me in that year was that they said this amazing thing. They would say, this isn't about healing. Maybe we can't, we can't. And so I learned to sit with extraordinary discomfort. I learned to sit with extraordinary anxiety. And sort of through doing that, become a different kind of strong than I had been in the past. And I think that opened to a different kind of compassion, both to like to myself, but also to other people, to my mother. I mean, I think that was the year I didn't kill myself, although I don't know, maybe every year is that for us. But
It's clearly a critical moment, right? It's a pivotal moment.
Absolutely.
And what's interesting to hear you say that is to say, well, I finally learned to sit with it. But you've been doing that your whole life, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. And that's the poet's job, really, if they're doing their job well. And so you get brought to the next stage so that, all right, so Gabby handled that one pretty well. Let's give Gabby the next one. Let's see what happens when we make her go, right?
That's right, yeah.
And so, and does that, but, and also if you agree that this is what poetry is all about, about standing in these horrible liminal spaces where we can't get an answer, you'd been doing it in your poetry. Did your poetry change?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting. I don't know that I think it changed so much for the next book, which is interesting. The next book, which is Apocalyptic Swing, which it's a book I care about a lot. I think that it did change in the sense that a kind of joy came into it. I mean, that is a book that is like, oh my gosh, like, wow, I didn't slay the dragon. Like, I learned to, like, have pancakes with the dragon. Like,
yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah. I am the dragon.
That's going to work out. I am the dragon. That's going to work out better in the long run, you know? So there's a kind of joyfulness. There's a way of talking about violence and talking about fear in that book that, is super different than the first book.
Would you read A Love Supreme?
Sure. And I also, like, I was really listening to I've always listened to music a lot. I played saxophone when I was little. That musicality, the jazz of faith and grace came back into me. A Love Supreme. You beautiful broke-back horse of my heart. Proud, debonair, not quite there in the head. You current with no river in sight. Current as confetti after parades. You small town. Italian ice shop next to brothels beside the highway, sweet and sweaty. You high as a kite coming down. You suburban sprawled all over the bed. You dead, not nearly, not yet. I will also say that is also a poem One thing I thought I was never going to do after my first book was like write another poem about my mother dying. I thought like I'm done with that, as many of us think when we're writing or doing anything. And then I immediately, you know, wrote a book of poems about my mother. But
well, what is it? What joy. Is that? Where does, you know, Love Supreme, is this an homage to Coltrane? How mm-hmm. much is he? Is that thought going through your head?
Yeah.
Where does your mother fit into that picture? Take us through that process.
Yeah, I mean, so Coltrane was a huge figure in this book. And part, the sort of surface relationships, there are a lot of poems that reference A Love Supreme. The secret song in that book is the Coltrane song Alabama that he composes after the terrible bombings and the four little girls being murdered. And there's that was a song I had been listening to a lot, and in part because the song also really follows the intonations of Dr. King's eulogy. And so sort of thinking about that on a poetic level was important to me. But also there was this notion of kind of Coltrane as someone who I had listened to when I was very, very little, and I began playing the alto saxophone, third grade, like the instrument, so giant. My dad got me all of these albums, all this vinyl, and I would like put John Coltrane on my little like Fisher-Price record player, and I would play it, you know, with the cornfields all around me, and I would try and play along. So part of this book is also the pleasure of trying to play along mm-hmm. again, and also the understanding that like within that suite of music, A Love Supreme, like, there's real joy, but there's also just like incredible tension. I mean, that's a piece of right. music where everything is sitting with itself. Yeah. You know, there's so many ways of being. And that somewhere in that song is my mother too, you know. I mean, within the joy, there's also the real, real sorrow and deprivation of her life, but also possibly like the joy that I couldn't hear. Like, yeah. This was the book where I also realized, like, it is possible my mother had an entire life without me, you know.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, and Train was actually criticized when that album came out as sort of having abandoned any kind of political ethos, mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That jazz was, starting in the 50s, a political statement,
yeah.
and that he had somehow abandoned that. But as you point out, not so. It just yeah. wasn't in that way that maybe some critics had hoped or expected.
Yeah, and I think that it's also interesting because, and that is definitely something about Coltrane that I think became very important in this book for me, was also this idea of Coltrane at a point in his musical life where like he's pushing up right at the limits of what the sort of structures that he had used before could do for him, mm-hmm. and wanting to push out of those. It's interesting to me, John Coltrane is all over the second book, and this third book is entirely Alice Coltrane, which I am like ashamed to say I wouldn't have gotten to had I not listened to John Coltrane. It would be really good and say something a little more profound about me as a person. Well, both say something profound about me as a person, but if I had gotten to Alice Coltrane first. But you know, there is really something about that too, this notion that he's pushing toward a kind of different edge of himself as an artist.
Right.
And that's a political thing.
It is a political thing, and again, the you know, sort of headline politics don't leave the work either, but it's in a much more nuanced way. So
yeah.
you have somebody. Is that
yeah.
the poet's job, do you think? I mean, to be conscious of themselves as an artist, as a craftsperson, mm-hmm. But also to you know, manage themselves within the world and all of its turmoil and be part of that, or can you?
Yeah.
Say, well, look, that's.
I mean, I think it. You know, this becomes, like, is this the central conversation about poetry? Maybe. I mean, it's one of them, right? Like, what is the role of the poet? What is the role of the poem? You know, and I think there are a lot of ways to answer that. I mean, one thing I would say is there's lots of different kinds of poetry and lots of different kinds of poetics. There's also lots of different ways to be political. And I think, and what does that word mean? You know, for myself, I think of myself as a fairly activist person. That comes in and out of the poems in different ways. I think that what is important for any poet, no matter what kind of poetry they're writing, and where they center themselves in their poetry, where they center current events in their poetry, is it is the job of the poet to always be looking, and it is the job of the poet to always be listening and always be interacting with every part of the world, like particularly those parts that make you uncomfortable. And I think we all know when we're reading a mausoleum, you know, and when we're reading a mausoleum, that's like, that's when there's a poet that's not really interested.
And your personal life got no less interesting as your professional life developed. Mm-hmm. You met your long-lost brother at a certain point. Tell us that story.
I met my long-lost brother. My long-lost brother met me. I had known – my mom was – she got pregnant pre-Roe v. Wade. And she was one of the young women in America who was sent to a home for Catholic girls, and which we're learning more and more about. She had a son, and I did not find out about him until after she passed away. She never spoke to him about me. She never spoke to him about me. Well, it's a Freudian moment. She never spoke to me about him that I can remember. But I found out about him, but I then felt that it became pretty clear that it was going to be really hard to find him. And also, I have to admit, like, I didn't really know, like, what would I say to him? This was not a happy story. And as I was thinking these things through for many years, actually, the day we were driving to move to Chapel Hill for this job at UNC, and all of a sudden, on Facebook, there was a note from a woman saying, could you call me? I'd like to talk to you about your mother. Because I'm out in the world in various ways and I talk about my mom a lot, periodically I will get notes from people who were in the hospital with her. And so I wrote and I said, could you just let me know what this is about? And then, you know, we can be in touch. But by the time that was maybe Memphis or something. I forget where we were then. We were driving. But by the time we got to – we were in Nashville. By the time we got to Knoxville, I said to my partner, I said, this person is my brother's sister. I don't know how I knew, but I just said like – and indeed, I looked at my Facebook account when we got to the hotel. And she said, I totally understand. I didn't know if you know, but – your mother, when she was 16, had a son who she gave up for adoption, and I am his adopted sister. And so this has begun a pretty, like, remarkable, complicated, wonderful, difficult journey of getting to know this man. I mean, he's older than me. We're very different in terms of our politics and in terms of, like, you know, how we live in the world. And I will say, like, first of all, he looks very much like my mother, and I don't. And I think there's maybe pictures online of her. That was stunning to me, to see this person who looks so much like my mother. But I will say, I don't know if anyone has had this experience who's listening with, like, meeting an adopted sibling. Like, however different we are, when I heard his voice for the first time, like, I love him like I don't love anyone else in the world. Like, I can't explain it. It's unbelievable.
Does it change how you feel about yourself when you hear that voice and meet this other sort of connection that you didn't know?
It does and it doesn't. Like, it does in the sense that I always wanted an older brother. Like, I really did. And so it sometimes makes me, like, sad and, like, oh, gosh, like, there he is. I think that, at least in my experience, this has been an experience of also understanding, like, the gifts and the limits of a life spent apart from someone, and certain kinds of closeness that can be achieved and others that maybe can't. And partially because, you know, my mother is as much a mystery to me as she will ever be to him. And that's hard. Like, that's hard for both of us. And I wish I could answer all the questions, but I think I am a vessel who just results in more questions.
It's a good thing we talked about your latest volume, Rocket Fantastic, the last time you were here, because we're out of time now to talk more about that. So we'll just have to have you back.
Oh, my gosh. Anytime.
Gabrielle Calvacaresi is a professor of English and the Walker Percy Fellow in Poetry at UNC Chapel Hill. You can find links to her work, including Rocket Fantastic, at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon, Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.